Steel, first in the electrifying new series by JD Masters. He's the perfect combination of man and machine, armed with the firepower of a high-tech army. This is Steel. For Ralph Leone, with special thanks to Kevin Bishop. Chapter 1. The throat-rending scream echoed down the alley like the screech of an approaching express train. It bounced off the walls and it continued building, rising in pitch and going on and on until it finally died out in an awful, rasping gurgle. Officer Rick Corsetti felt a chill race down his spine. It hardly seemed possible that anything human could produce such a horrifying sound.
"Jesus Christ," he said softly.
"Guess again, kid," said Lieutenant Steele. Corsetti glanced at him and managed a weak grin that had no mirth behind it. Screamers terrified him. He had seen them on the news and in police briefing training films, but had never actually encountered one before. And now he'd have to face one on his first time out. He felt his insides knotting up. He shifted the short, polymer, ceramic battle rifle from one hand to the other. It had two barrels, one capable of firing 4.7mm caseless ammunition, and the other 12-gauge shotgun rounds. He was suddenly having trouble keeping a firm grasp on it. His palms were sweating. He wiped them on his pants. He was more than well enough equipped to take out a solitary screamer, but that hideous howling had unnerved him. Screamers weren't afraid of anything. In the training films, he'd seen footage of screamers who'd had entire pistol magazines emptied into them and still kept on coming. There was only one way to take them out. You had to drop them hard and put them down for keeps. When he first started training with the Strike Force, he'd found the weight of all the gear they carried extremely burdensome, but now he was grateful for the battle rifle and the big 44 Magnum semi-automatic in the Cordura holster strapped to his right thigh, as well as the 9mm in the shoulder holster under his left arm. His belt rig and shoulder harnesses held spare magazine clips for both weapons and spare ammo for the battle rifle, as well as a billy club, a heavy steel flashlight, handcuffs, flares, a first aid kit, plastic explosive, and a wire garrote. There was a large commando bowie in a self-sharpening sheath strapped to his left thigh and a small polymer ceramic 9mm semi-automatic backup pistol snugged down in a boot holster over his right ankle. He wore the black Strike Force combat uniform with a lightweight two-piece undersuit, including gloves and socks, all with integral zoned electrical heating that was powered and controlled by the computer in his backpack. The backpack also carried two small vertically launched short-range missiles that could be programmed and launched by voice command to the computer. The outer uniform was porous and infrared absorbent. Over it, he wore a tactical body armor with a harness for equipment pouches. He had on articulated armored boots and a matte black Strike Force Riot helmet with a built-in radio mic and speakers. It covered his entire head and contained a gyro-stabilized laser designator, an image intensifier, and a thermal imaging camera. The visor screen provided a display projected from the video system that included alphanumeric information and graphic images such as maps and plans stored in his computer, as well as aiming marks for his weapons. All he had to do was move his weapon until the slaved aiming mark on his visor was on target, and then the fire with pinpoint accuracy. Half a dozen of his fellow trainees, similarly equipped, stood with him on the cracked and buckled sidewalk, each carrying enough ordnance to take on a small army. And in this neighborhood, there was every chance they would encounter one. They stood in the lower section of Manhattan, near Whitehall and Battery Park. The area that had once been the financial district of Wall Street was only several blocks away, but the stock market was now nothing but a memory, buried in the rubble of twisted steel, shattered glass, and crumbled concrete. One of the World Trade Center towers poked up into the sky above them. More than half of it sheared off. The other tower had been destroyed almost completely. This is a good time to remind you that this was written in 1989. A short distance away in New York Harbor, the Statue of Liberty had been reduced to molten slag. Hardly anything remained of Staten Island, where a missile meant for Midtown Manhattan had struck just a bit off target. Nobody knew if anyone was left alive out there. If there were any survivors, they were on their own. Corsetti and his fellow Strike Force trainees had been choppered into the southern tip of the island, part of the no-man's land that surrounded Midtown, an area that included everything south of Houston Street and east of 2nd Avenue up to 34th Street, as well as the entire strip along the Hudson River from Battery Park to the Lincoln Tunnel. From 34th Street up to 110th, just north of Central Park, the city had remained more or less unscathed. But everything north of 110th Street was a free fire zone, populated by derelicts and screamers, outlaws and paramilitary street gangs. What had once been the greatest city in the world had collapsed into itself like some kind of dying star, its mass densely clustered at the center, surrounded by a twilight zone of urban jungle. The Bronx was largely deserted, a DMZ which no single entity had overall control. Though a number of outlaw settlements somehow managed to hang on there, scratching and clawing for survival like hyenas over a fresh kill. Long Island was largely the province of the mobs, well-organized crime families that controlled the street gangs in the city and maintained large, heavily fortified enclaves in Queens. On the North Shore near Cold Spring Harbor and on the South Shore in Long Beach and Brooklyn, the eastern part of Long Island, what had once been Nassau and Suffolk counties, was largely deserted except for a stronghold out in Montauk, controlled by a large and heavily armed gang of outlaw bikers called the Brood, who lived in uneasy coexistence with the mobs, a truce governed by formal treaties based on mutual need and respect for turf. The mobs funneled arms, fuel, and various other necessities to the Brood enclave in exchange for produce from the agrarian communities that the Brood controlled, as well as seafood from the fishing fleets they operated. Midtown was denied the benefits of any such exchange. It contained the remnants of a woefully decentralized federal government, one that did not recognize the criminal enclaves on Long Island. For its supplies, the city drew on certain areas in upstate New York and New Jersey, and those cities on the eastern seaboard that still had some semblance of a functioning authority. Washington, D.C. had been nuked into oblivion the first day of the war, the area for several hundred miles around it, too hot to enter. The government, what remained of it, had established bases in New York and in the larger cities such as Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, and Atlanta. Texas had declared its independence, making Dallas the seat of government. Miami had become a modern version of the Dry Tortugas, a sort of free state with semi-independent status, a haven for pirates from the Gulf and the Caribbean, as well as from every other sort of hustler, criminal, and freebooter from Savannah to the Florida Keys. Much of the Southwest, with the exception of cities such as Phoenix, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque, had regressed to the frontier lifestyle of the 1800s. The Northwest, the mountain states, Idaho, Montana, Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming, had been the hardest hit. There were still a lot of hot spots out there. Isolated pockets of civilization existed in Washington and Oregon, but no one knew what was going on in Nevada or California, as well as most of the rural areas in what had once been the United States. There was no contact with Alaska or Hawaii, and though Canada and Mexico had sustained no missile strikes, their death toll from the virus had been just as staggering. Rick Corsetti and the other young officers with him had all applied for the Strike Force training, and this was the final phase of their field testing. One day each week, Lieutenant Donovan Steele was relieved of his regular Strike Force duties to oversee the training of new candidates who were drawn from the regular ranks of the police force. There was a constant demand for new blood at the police commando unit because the mortality rate among the Strike Force cops was very high. A veteran senior officer, Steele had beat the odds, and along with a picked group of his fellow officers, had been chosen to rotate on training duty in the hope that he could pass on some of his hard-earned skills and knowledge to those candidates who had already completed their classroom training and passed their rigorous exams. But unlike some of his superiors in the department, Steele did not believe that numbers alone would provide an adequate solution to the problem. To his way of thinking, the answer lay not in simply bringing in new bodies to replace those that had died, but to bring in people who could manage to survive much longer. And he had his own methods of separating those who could make the grade from those who would simply flesh out the statistics. "Corsetti," he said, as the screamer hidden somewhere out in the attic howled once more, "take him out." Corsetti glanced at Steele uncertainly, his confidence suddenly faltering. "You mean alone?" "Yeah," said Steele. "Why, you figure you need help?" Corsetti swallowed hard, grateful for the fact that Steele couldn't see the expression on his face.
No, sir. He moistened his lips. "I guess I could handle it."
"You guess?" Corsetti tried to keep his voice from cracking. He took a deep breath.
"I can handle it, sir."
"Good. So handle it," said Steele. Corsetti glanced at his fellow trainees, moistened his lips, and moved off towards the alley. The scream rang out once more, a sound like a soul being torn apart in hell. Corsetti felt a trickle of sweat deep seep down his back. "Corsetti," Steele said, before he had gone more than half a dozen steps. Corsetti paused, looking back. "Before you go in there, why don't you tell us what you're going to use to take him out?" Corsetti hesitated.
"Well, I figured I'd use the shotgun, sir. It'll be close in there with no citizen bystanders in the line of fire. The shotgun should give me a good spread with the best chance of putting him down quickly."
Steele nodded. "Good thinking."
"Thank you, sir."
"Too bad your weapon isn't loaded."
Corsetti stared at him. "What?"
"You did check your weapons, didn't you?" Corsetti glanced down at the battle rifle, chinned the switch in his helmet, and said, "Shotgun, 25 meters, chamber one round." A small, repetitive beeping sounded in his helmet, and bright blue letters spelling out, "Magazine, empty," appeared in his visor. There weren't any shells in the tube. Stunned, he spoke the words, "Rifle, 25 meters, select fire, three-round burst." The same thing happened. It was empty. He stared back at Steele with incomprehension. "But it was loaded. I checked." "When?" asked Steele. "This morning when we went out. I know it was loaded. I checked it myself." "That's right," said Steele. "I saw you check it when you drew your weapons. Only I unloaded it when we were waiting on the chopper pad." Corsetti stared at him through his visor. But I didn't see." "That's right, Corsetti. You didn't see me do it. And you know why you didn't see me do it?" Corsetti licked his lips nervously. Because you set your weapons down where you couldn't keep an eye on it. And you were so busy jawing with your buddies that you didn't see me pick it up and switch the magazines. And just now, when you should have checked it once again, you didn't. You simply took it for granted that it was loaded. You were about to go in there and face a screamer in close quarters with an empty weapon. What else did you take for granted, Corsetti?" Corsetti bit his lower lip. He fumbled for the pouch on his ring belt containing the spare shells. It was empty. Alarmed, he checked the other magazine pockets. All of the spare ammunition clips had been removed. "Didn't the belt seem a little light to you, Corsetti?" Steele said. Corsetti swallowed hard.
I didn't notice."
"Yes, I know. I wonder what else you didn't notice." Corsetti slapped at the holster on his thigh, pulled out the big 44, and checked the magazine. He sighed with relief.
"It's loaded," he said.
"Are you sure?" Steele said. Corsetti was suddenly uncertain. He fumbled for the clip, pulled it out once again, and checked it for the second time. He could see the first round exposed at the top of the clip. The others stacked beneath it were visible through the small holes in the side of the magazine.
"Yes, sir," he said, sounding relieved as he entered the clip back into the pistol. "It's fully loaded."
"Well, if you're sure," said Steele with a shrug. Corsetti stared at him. Suddenly, he was no longer sure of anything. He removed the magazine and looked at it.
"Yes, sir, I'm sure."
"All right, you are, huh? You loaded it yourself, did you?" Corsetti hadn't loaded it himself. He had drawn the weapons from the ordnance selection that morning, and magazines were already loaded, or at least he had assumed they were. He thumbed out the first round and spring pressure pushed the next one to the top of the clip. It was blank. He stared at it with disbelief. "I'll save you the trouble of checking the rest of your weapons," Steele said. "The ones on the top are all your live rounds. The rest are blanks. Counting your 44, your duty piece, and your backup, you've only got three live rounds." Corsetti suddenly felt cold all over. "And you're still going in alone," said Steele.
"No, wait,"
Corsetti said, panic welling up within him.
You can't send me in alone without weapons. I wouldn't stand a chance."
"You've got your knife and you've got three rounds," Steele said, "which is a lot more than that screamer's got." Another horrifying scream rang out from the alley. It sounded closer. Corsetti stared wildly at the entrance to the alley. He glanced at Steele, then looked back at the alley once again.
Hell, this is crazy, he said, shaking his head. I ain't going in there like this. No way.
Steele unholstered his 45 Colt semi-automatic and racked the side. Oh, yes, you are, he said. He aimed the gun at the trainee's visor. Corsetti's gaze was riveted to the barrel of Steele's pistol. At this range, it would be easily penetrate the visor. His lower lip began to tremble.
You can't be serious.
Try me. The gun was rock steady in Steele's hand. Hey, Lieutenant, come on, said one of the other trainees, sounding nervous. You're not really gonna. As you were, snapped Steele. The man instantly fell silent. Nobody moved. The rest of the trainees watched with disbelief. Corsetti started to hyperventilate.
No, wait, please, he said, his voice cracking. Wait, please, wait.
What's it going to be, Corsetti?
Please, Lieutenant, please don't make me go in there alone. Please, I can't.
You've got 3 seconds to get in there, said Steele, or you're finished. Corsetti glanced from Steele to the alley and back to Steele again. His stomach was churning. He felt as if he were going to throw up inside his helmet. He saw himself going down into the alley, saw the screamer charging at him, howling like a banshee, covered with the hideous, separating sores.
Is that what you want, Corsetti? Steele said, his voice like a whip crack. You want to quit?
The screamer in the alley howled again. He was moving closer. The other trainees all stood immobile. The quick gasp of Corsetti's panic breathing came in through their helmet speakers. They heard him start to whimper. He stood there, rooted to the spot, tense, shoulders twisting slightly from side to side, head jerking from the alley to Steele and back again. I can't! Corsetti sobbed. I just can't! His shoulders slumped and he looked down to the ground. Steele lowered his gun.
Anderson! He said. You can come out now.
A moment later, a Strike Force cop in riot gear stepped out of the alley. He held a portable radio slap tape recorder in his left hand. He hit the play button, and the sound of the scream welled up from the speakers. Corsetti gave a small gasp and looked from him to Steele and back again.
Jesus Christ, he said, breathing hard. It was nothing but a trick. A lousy goddamn trick.
That's right, kid, Steele said, holstering his pistol. But it could have been for real.
Wait, that isn't fair, Corsetti cried. You tricked me.
Yeah, I tricked you, Steele said. I don't think you had what it takes to be a Strike Force cop, and you just proved me right. You panicked, Corsetti. You broke, and a Strike Force cop just can't afford to break.
I'm sorry, Corsetti said, looking away. I really like another chance, sir.
That was a real screamer in there, Steele said. You think you would have gotten another chance?
Corsetti looked down at his feet. He felt utterly miserable. All that work, all those weeks of training, all for nothing.
No, sir, he said softly. I guess not.
You guess right, said Steele. But look on the bright side. You'll probably live a whole lot longer. He turned to the other trainees. I suggest you all give some serious thought to what you would have done if you had been in Corsetti's place just now. If you haven't gotten in you to go in and get the job done when all the odds are against you, then now's the time to admit to yourselves while you still got the chance.
He called in the chopper. Suddenly, a shot cracked out. One of the trainees, a man named Adams, cried out and fell, wounded in the leg.
Take cover, Steele shouted.
He helped Adams up, supporting him as he ran for the shelter of the ruined building. More shots cracked out rapidly, like exploding firecrackers, ricocheting off the sidewalk and the building walls. Stunned, Corsetti remained standing out where he was.
Corsetti, Steele yelled. Get out of there!
Several shots struck Corsetti in the chest, impacting on his flak vest and hurling him backwards. He fell and remained lying on the buckled sidewalk, motionless.
God damn it, said Steele through the clenched teeth. Anderson, I thought you said your unit had secured this area.
We did, said Anderson.
Then where the hell did those guys come from?
I don't know, said Anderson, limbering his assault rifle. They must have slipped in past the perimeter somehow.
Great, said Steele through gritted teeth. Give me some cover, he yelled out.
The trainees started laying down fire in the direction of the building where the shots were coming from. Steele got up and started running a zigzag pattern from where Corsetti lay.
Sir, said one of the trainees to Anderson, is this another drill?
No, it's not a drill, you idiot,
said Anderson. He switched on his helmet mic.
Carson, come in. Where the hell are you?
We're pinned down.
We can hear it, Andy. Carson's voice came back over the loudspeakers.
Hang tight. We're on our way.
Well, move it, for God's sake.
Steele reached the spot where Corsetti lay, stunned by the impacts of the bullets on his flak vest. He had been hit once in the upper arm, and one of the bullets had struck his leg. He was bleeding badly.
Come on, Corsetti, Steele said. Come on, damn it. Get up. You get up.
A bullet whined off the sidewalk about an inch from his right foot. Another one whistled past his head. Corsetti didn't budge.
Shit,
swore Steele. He crouched down and launched both rockets from his backpack. They struck the building where the shots were coming from and exploded with a concussive roar. He picked Corsetti up in a fireman's carry. He started to zigzag back to where the others were. He felt the impact of a bullet in the back of his flak vest, and he stumbled but managed to retain his balance and keep moving. More small arms fire erupted as Anderson's Strike Force unit arrived on the scene, moving in from two sides of the building the shots were coming from. The loud staccato chatter of the helicopter blades filled the air as the police chopper descended, its machine gun turrets blazing. 50 caliber rounds slamming into the deserted buildings where the attackers had taken shelter. Carson and his men kept their distance, setting up a perimeter around the building as the chopper pilot fired two rockets into the second floor.
Now, said Anderson, come on, move it! Move it!
The trainees started to spring towards the chopper, hovering just above the street level. Steele had already dumped Corsetti through the hatch and was lying down covering fire.
Come on, come on!
He yelled, waving his arm. Several figures emerged from the smoking rubble of the building. Carson's unit cut them down as they hit the street. At last, the trainees boarded the chopper. Steele waved the pilot off.
Go on! Get out of here!
The pilot needed no encouragement. A chopper on the ground was vulnerable. As he lifted off, Steele and Anderson sprinted out to where Carson and his men were. There was still some sporadic fire coming from the upper windows of the building. Smoke poured out the windows. A screaming figure, wreathed in flames, came running out of a huge fissure in the wall. Steele dropped him in his tracks. Machine gun fire clattered from a shattered window up on the third floor, and Carson's men poured their fire into it. Small puffs of concrete, dust, and chips erupted from the wall where some of the bullets struck. Two of the men launched their backpack missiles, and they struck the side of the building, bringing down a large part of the wall. The fire from the building ceased. "Hold your fire!" Anderson shouted. They stopped shooting. Black smoke poured from gaping holes in the building. Flames licked from the windows and the huge fissures in the wall. Part of the building had collapsed. "I think we got him," said Carson.
"How the hell did they get past you in the first place?"
Steele snapped. Carson shook his head. "I don't know. Unless maybe they came up through the sewers."
"Everyone all right?"
asked Steele. Carson glanced around his men. "Looks like," he said, "we got off quick and easy this time. No casualties."
"Wrong," said Steele. "I've got two wounded trainees, Adams and Corsetti."
Carson shrugged. "Could have been worse," he said.
"Yeah,"
said Steele sourly. "You want us to go in there and check for any survivors?" Carson said.
"Are you kidding?" said Steele. "The whole building is liable to fall in on you. If anyone's still alive in there, then let the bastards burn."
He approached one of the bodies and turned it over with his foot.
"Jingos,"
he said, identifying the street gang member by his colors. "This one's a green dragon," Anderson said, standing by another body.
"What?"
said Steele. He went over to where Anderson stood, lifted his visor, and looked down at the bullet-riddled corpse.
"Christ, what the hell are the Chingos and the dragons doing running together?"
he said. "You got me," Anderson said, "but it's not what I'd call good news. Who's writing the report on this one, you or me?"
"I was in charge. I guess I have to," said Steele.
"The captain won't be very happy about this," Anderson said.
"He's never happy about anything," said Steele. "Particularly me,"
he added with a grimace. He sighed.
"Come on, let's get the hell out of here."
The experts who had predicted all the various scenarios for World War III, from winnable atomic wars to nuclear winter, had all failed to anticipate the one that came. It came not from a rain of fire, not in a rain of fire, but like an invisible fog that blanketed the world, killing everything it touched. It was not a war of nation against nation, but of humanity against a deadly virus created in the lab. A virulent strain against which the human body had absolutely no defense. It was a war brought upon not by competing superpowers, but by a zealous group of terrorists, self-styled freedom fighters acting in the name of Islam. They had sought to bring the superpowers to their knees by releasing a deadly airborne virus simultaneously in major cities throughout the world, but the terrorists had underestimated the effects of the plague they had unleashed and the incredible speed with which it spread. The virus attacked the nervous system, killing its victims in seconds. Billions died before they even knew what hit them. The major superpowers, each thinking the other was responsible, had ordered immediate retaliatory strikes. But only a small portion of their nuclear arsenals were actually launched, even as the dreaded order was given. Launch control personnel keeled over at their posts, dying before they could hit the button, leaving armed missiles standing in the silos. In a matter of days, the population of the world had been reduced to a tenth of what it had been. The human race might have died out completely if the virus had not undergone a rapid series of mutations. The first and second mutations were only a little less deadly than the original form. Those strains of the virus killed more slowly, sparing some of its victims, those lucky few who had somehow managed to acquire immunities to its effects. The third mutation, while not immediately fatal to its victims, produced what came to be called as the Screamers, a carrier population left physically and mentally ravaged by the virus. Most of them were hopelessly insane. Most of them. Their bodies, a hideous mass of painful, separating sores, The psychopathic screamers would attack anything that moved, and most of those they touched became infected themselves, turning into screamers in a matter of hours or even minutes with no hope of ever being cured. The fourth mutation led to a strain of virus that attacked only the motor system, leaving its victims progressively crippled, their nerves and muscles gradually wasting away as the virus destroyed the myelin sheaths of the nerve fibers. The fifth mutation brought the deadly cycle to an end. The virus was transformed finally into a comparatively harmless organism that posed a threat only to the very old and weak, whose immune systems no longer functioned properly. It brought on something very much like pneumonia. Not fatal in itself, but enough to weaken the body and leave it open to further infection. The victims usually died of complications within 6 months to a year. Donovan Steele, born in the mid-21st century, was one of the survivors. He was 16 years old when his mother had become a screamer. She had been a hospital lab technician working with a team of doctors desperately struggling to find the cure for virus 3, the third mutation, which had produced the screamers, when a vial containing a sample of contaminated blood broke and she became infected. Panic-stricken, she had fled the lab, intending to kill herself before she succumbed to the virus, but it struck her mind with a strong... astonishing rapidity. She was already raving when she came home, driven by some instinct to seek out her family. Steele never forgot the sight of his mother bursting through the door like some half-human beast, already breaking out in sores and screaming, "My children! My children!" She had flung herself upon his 10-year-old brother, Jim, crushing him to her chest and covering him with kisses. Then suddenly, he started screaming as she began to bite him. Stunned, Steele watched as she flung Jim away from her and leaped upon his youngest brother, Michael, only 6 years old. By the time his father got to her and pried her loose, Michael had been bitten too. Steele watched helplessly as his father struggled with his mother, who fought her with almost superhuman strength. He finally managed to smash a chair over her back and stun her. Then he ran quickly to his desk, took out his pistol, racked the slide, aimed, and shot her in the head. Only in trying to subdue her, he had become himself infected. Steele never forgot the way his father looked at him with tears in his eyes, his voice breaking as he said, "Son, I hope someday you'll understand this. You're going to have to be a man now and take it on your own somehow." "Dad, I haven't got much time, but no, don't come near me. Stay right there." He froze as his father backed away from him. "Whatever happens, Donnie," said his father, "don't touch us. Don't come near any of us. Promise me. Promise me." I promise, Dad." "Call the police. They'll tell you what to do, Jimmy. Michael, come here to Daddy." The two frightened, crying boys came running to them, and their father hugged them both and then told them to turn around. As they did so, he quickly shot each of them through the back of the head. Steele had screamed, and in the next instant, his father had struck the barrel of his gun into his own mouth and pulled the trigger. Donovan Steele had been left alone, faced with having to survive in a world that had gone mad. Numb with shock, he had done exactly as his father had told him to. He didn't go near their bodies. He called the police. They came quickly and took charge, seeing to the proper disposal of the bodies. One of the officers, a man whose name he only remembered as Joe, had spent a long time talking to him, trying to comfort him and explain the reason for what his father had done after Steele had told him what had happened. The man's kindness and concern, his strength and competence had made an indelible impression upon Steele. Later, they took him to a hospital where he had his first experience speaking with a psychiatrist. It made him angry and uncomfortable, and he wanted to speak to Joe once more, but he never saw that officer again. He was taken to a home for orphan children, and he lived there until he turned 18 and enrolled in the police academy. The grim determination that had seen him through had tempered him till he became as cold and hard as the name he bore. Now, at the age of 43, that's important, remember that, he had worked his way up through the ranks and was a senior officer in the Special Operations Division of the NYPD, an elite commando unit commonly referred to as the Strike Force, with headquarters in what had once been known as the Pan Am Building on Park Avenue. This is how you know it was written in the 80s. Now it was just known simply as the Tower, a vertical fortress housing the various precinct headquarters and central administration of the New York Police Department, as well as the armories, the labs, the firing ranges, even dormitories and apartments. The tower was centrally located close to the Federal Plaza, once known as the UN Plaza, and additional police and federal helicopters along the East River. The vast majority of officers in the department were assigned to patrol Midtown and protected citizens, many of whom were armed and hired their own protection in the form of private security personnel who guarded the buildings where they lived. Private security had become a growth industry in the aftermath of the Bile War, and it was regulated by the NYPD. The strike force had the unenviable job of trying to clean up the no man's land surrounding Midtown, a task that was on par with trying to rid the entire island of its rats and roaches. The strike force cops were, as a rule, cynical and philosophical about their chances for success. Okay. They knew they were, at best, fighting a holding action. The only way they'd ever clean out all the vermin would be to level everything inside the city, or outside Midtown. Simply raise it to the ground and finish what the war had started. Even if they had the ability to do that, there was still the subway tunnels and the sewers and all the maintenance tunnel and the conduits, and God only knew what other forgotten labyrinths that existed underneath the city, carved out by sand hogs throughout the centuries. That was a sentence. At one time, many years ago, the crime problem in New York had caused many people to christen it Fear City. It was now much more worse than that. It was a bloody nightmare. Steele checked his gear and weapons with the armory, all except his personal 45 Colt Duty piece and 9mm backup pistol. So just those two guns. Then took the elevator up to the division headquarters of the strike force on the 32nd floor. He went down the hall past the administration wing and entered the division offices, going on through to the captain's offices. He paused at the door and knocked. "Come in," said a surly voice from the inside. "Come in," said a surly voice from the inside. He opened the door and entered. Captain Jacob Hardesty was at his desk, looking through some papers. These days, all he ever seemed to do was look through papers and reports. But at one time, he had been one of the finest strike force cops to hit the streets. He was a heavy set and his close-cropped hair prematurely white. Wags in the department said it turned out that way when old Hard
Wait, when old hard ass was promoted to his desk. Okay, his eyes were bright blue and his jaw square, giving him the look of a pugnacious bulldog. He looked up as Steele entered and scowled.
You wanted to see me, sir? You bet your ass I wanted to see you, Hardesty said.
His voice sounded like gravel rattling in a can.
What the hell did you think you were doing? Sending a trainee out with unloaded weapons and magazines loaded up with blanks, for God's sakes!
Hardesty, as usual, knew everything that had happened. Steele wondered how he did it. Either he had spies among the men reporting to him directly, or he had everybody's rectum bugged. You couldn't fart without him knowing about it.
That's not quite true, sir. We had 3 live rounds. That many?
Hardesty said sarcastically.
And I was carrying a full load of spare clips and shells for him in addition to my own gear.
Steele finished patiently.
I was trying to teach the man a lesson. You sure taught him that, all right? You almost got him killed!
Grissetti froze, sir. He broke. The man wasn't SOD material.
It's not your damn job to decide who's SOD material and who isn't, Hardesty snapped. Your job is to train these people, Steele, and submit your evaluation forms at the conclusion of each exercise. If you think somebody doesn't measure up for one reason or another, you put that in your report. Everybody else does it. What makes you so goddamn different?
With all due respect, sir, I didn't think Grissetti was cut out for strike force duty. According to his file and my own observations, he was a chronic screw-up.
He had a tendency to be sloppy and careless. That could get him killed, and it could get his partners killed. I needed to put him in a pressure situation so I could see how he'd responded. So you pointed your weapon at him and threatened to shoot him?
Hardesty said.
You know I never would have shot him, Steele said. The point is, he didn't know it. That's right, but I gave the man a choice. To go up against a screamer with nothing but 3 bullets and a knife, or to be shot by his own training officer,
said Hardesty, his voice rising.
There never was a screamer, sir. If there were, I never would have sent him out like that. It was all an exercise I set up with Sergeant Anderson for the benefit of the other trainees, and for Corsetti's own benefit as well. For his own benefit, said Hardesty. You humiliated that man in front of his fellow officers. You stripped him of his self-respect, and on top of that, you almost got him killed.
Hardesty took a deep breath and shook his head with resignation.
Under the circumstances, I've got no choice but to now wash him out. And when he recovers, how the hell is he supposed to go back to regular duty patrol? How is he supposed to look at his brother officers in the face after what that's happened? He'll never be sure of himself again. I need manpower on the streets, Steele! But because of what you did, I'm not going to put a boy on a desk, assuming he doesn't quit the force!
A desk would be the best place for him, said Steele said. You can screw up all you want behind a desk. Hardesty's eyes were like cracked ice. His stare was cold and hard.
Now you listen to me, Steele, he said, struggling to keep his temper in check. I say you out there to teach those kids and toughen them up, not to destroy their egos.
I can't afford to worry about their egos, said Steele. I have to worry about their lives. We lose enough people as it is without sending out kids who'll crack under pressure and get themselves and their partners killed. That's not some game we're playing out there, are we?
Don't you tell me what we're doing out there, Steele, said Hardesty, rising from his chair, a dangerous edge to his voice. I was out there pulling strike force duty when you were still learning how to use the body. Where the hell do you get off talking to me like that?
I'm sorry, sir. I was merely trying to point out that you can't hammer a square peg into a round hole, not without causing some damage. Corsetti never would have cut it. I just helped him realize it. I did the kid a favor.
Yeah, said Hardesty, scowling. You sure did. Why don't you go visit him in the hospital and tell him that?
I intend to. Hardesty stared at him for a long moment, then took a deep breath and shook his head again as he sat back down.
Christ, Steele, your arrogance is simply unbelievable, he said. I'm pulling you off training duty as of right now.
Suits me, said Steele. I just as soon get back out to my squad full time.
I'm not finished yet, Hardesty said. I've had a special priority request from the feds. They've got some kind of research project going, and I've been asked to provide a volunteer test subject for them. You're elected. You're to...
What? Said Steele.
You're to report to Federal Plaza first thing in the morning. You're to see Dr. Carmody of Project Download in the research branch of...
You've got to be kidding, said Steele. Interrupted Steele.
You're assigning me to some dumb research project? I don't have time for this sort of nonsense.
Hardesty gripped the edge of his desk tightly and glared at him.
That's a direct order, Steele. You understand me?
Steele took a deep breath and let it out slowly through his clenched teeth.
Yeah. 1-900 tomorrow morning, Hardesty said. Be there!
End of chapter 1.